Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media.
Welcome to Earth Eats, a show of real food and green living. I'm Annie Corrigan.
I mean, most people just say chemical-free or some people say natural, but natural is really even more deflated than organic, so I don't really like using natural. Yeah, most people say, or eco-grown, you can use that term.
How does a farm describe itself when it's not allowed to use the word organic? Michael Hicks of Living Roots Eco Village talks about why he chose to not get his farm certified organic with the USDA. A couple stories from Harvest Public Media today about dairies in California being lured to Midwestern states. Then a couple recipes using raw veggies with Chef Daniel Orr. And the relationship between one farmer and one chef. Last week, we took a look back at food stories that made headlines in 2014. Time to look ahead today with Luann Johnson.
Here are several stories we're watching this January, Annie. McDonald's, suffering from consistent decline over the previous 13 months, has announced changes to its menu. The fast food chain will cut 8 menu options, streamline its extra value meal selection, and introduce mobile and web ordering. For those looking for speed, McDonald's hopes the menu slimming will result in faster drive-through times. The company also wants to compete with the fast casual crowd, think Chipotle and Panera, by introducing Create Your Taste platforms, which gives fast foodies the ability to customize their Big Macs. Outside the U.S., Russia will import food from Iran beginning in January. Russian officials have been meeting with Iranian food authorities to determine quality and have speculated that Iranian shrimp will be the first item to arrive in the Russian market. Products ranging from dairy to fish, other seafood, and produce will also be considered for export. In New Delhi, the Food Safety and Standards Authority of India will begin nationwide testing of products for adulteration. The 6-month testing run will examine products like milk, spices, and meat. And a new documentary will take you on the journey of General Tso, or at least the chicken that bears the name. General Tso's chicken is one of the most popular Chinese dishes in America, but many Chinese have never heard of it. The Search for General Tso explores how the dish rose to prominence in American Chinese cuisine and how it hardly resembles the Hunan dish of its origin. In case you missed it in December, food giant Unilever dropped its lawsuit against startup Just Mayo. Unilever, maker of Hellmann's mayonnaise, sued Hampton Creek, owner of Just Mayo, earlier in 2014, stating false advertising over the term mayo, since their product did not contain eggs. Just Mayo pointed out that they did not call their condiment mayonnaise for just that reason. Unilever conceded, saying Just Mayo can take the issue to industry groups and regulators.
We do want to direct you to our website to read more about these stories. It's eartheats.org. And connect with us on Twitter to get food news 24/7. We're at Earth Eats. Thanks to our bloggers, Chad Bouchard and Liz Leslie, for collecting these stories. And the voice of our headlines, Luann Johnson.
Thanks and Happy New Year.
California is the nation's number one dairy state. It's branded as the state with sunny and happy cows, but not necessarily happy dairy owners. For many of them, it's getting tougher to make a living. That's why some are selling their cattle and heading to the Midwest. For Harvest Public Media, Ezra David Romero reports in the first of a two-part series.
Brian Azevedo's done. He's done with California, the state he's called home for the entirety of his 26 years.
We realized that we could not stay here, like it is not viable.
Azevedo's a Portuguese-American dairy farmer in Merced, California. He, his parents, his brother, and sister have milked cows for 15 years. They rented a dairy with a herd of 600 and constantly dreamt of owning their own. But that dream has been hard to catch.
The cost of feeds here, exacerbated by the drought, as well as constant increasing in regulation, and the cost of those regulations have made it very difficult for a small operation like ourselves.
And the Azevedos aren't alone in the struggle dairymen face in California. Michael Marsh, the CEO of Western United Dairymen, says a full quarter of the state's dairies have closed since 2007.
They've just closed their doors, and they've decided to make their investment in other states.
He blames high feed costs, state and business environmental regulations, and the drought. He also blames almonds, The large demand and high profit margin for the nut has some dairymen leveling their operations and planting almond orchards.
As the dairy farmers have transitioned out of that business, some other permanent crop has come in to take the position where the dairy was.
Azevedo, the dairy farmer in Merced, wanted to give up his dairy farm, but didn't want to give up dairy farming.
I'm willing to talk to anybody and everybody.
That's David Skaggs. He works for South Dakota, luring dairies to the state. Skaggs met the Azevedos at the World Ag Expo in Tulare, California. The dairy pavilion there is full of recruiters from the Midwest, Iowa, Nebraska, Kansas, all vying for the attention of dairy farmers.
We have dairies that have relocated from Ireland, England, the Netherlands, numerous other states as well, but California seems to be a good target market for us.
South Dakota recruits so hard that the state's governor, Dennis Dugard, is involved in the recruiting. The state even uses a hashtag, GetSomeMilk2014. Dugard spoke with media at last year's expo.
We're trying to attract California dairymen to look at South Dakota's advantages for establishing a dairy.
South Dakota's message is this. The state has fewer regulations, processes permits quickly, has ample amount of land, and has plenty of cheese and milk processors.
Not only is the regulatory climate good, but the economics are very good. We don't have any personal income tax. We have no corporate income tax. Feed costs are low, and our milk prices are high.
Skaggs' goal is to double the number of dairy cows in the state.
Since I took over in 2005, we have grown our dairy industry from 81,000 dairy cows to 97,000 today. By the end of the year, we'll be over 100,000 cows.
Azevedo was hooked. He sold most of his cows, made multiple trips to South Dakota, and eventually bought a 117-acre dairy in the Mount Rushmore state for less than $1 million. It would have cost him at least twice as much in California. Every morning, Azevedo wakes up, grabs a pitchfork, and feeds the 60 cows he decided to keep with a hay, oat, and corn mix.
I'd much rather leave my home and go where I can have a dairy business and have cows do what I want to do versus stay here where I'm at and do something else. I think that I'll be happier over there versus being over here in better weather doing what I don't want to do.
And come mid-spring, the Azevedos will settle in South Dakota, leaving behind California's dairy world for what he hopes will be greener pastures. For Harvest Public Media, I'm Ezra David Romero.
That story came to us from Valley Public Radio in Fresno, California. Later today, we'll look at just how much an influx of dairies could be worth to the Midwest. Organic has become one of those buzzwords we hear all the time. Organic produce, organic farming, organic cooking. Student reporter Jamie Ordonez has a story of a farmer who embraces the organic ideal but dismisses the formal USDA certification process.
Living Roots is a farming eco-village in French Lick, Indiana. Home to about 10 farmers at a time, they produce tons and tons of produce each year. So what exactly is organic? The dictionary says it's, quote, of, relating to, or derived from living matter. And Michael, farming manager of Living Roots, says,
when you're organic, you're trying to like work with the land and you're trying to work with nature versus like conventional. Conventional is really trying to control nature.
The USDA, however, only lets you call yourself organic if you go through their certification process. But to Michael and the rest of Living Roots, you don't have to be certified to be organic. So when Michael or I just say organic, I mean the non-USDA kind. If I'm talking about the USDA definition, I'll say certified organic. Since technically we aren't supposed to be using the big O word, Michael plays with terminology.
What's a word you'd use to describe your farm?
I mean, most people just say chemical free, or some people say natural, but natural is really even more deflated than organic, so I don't really like using natural. Yeah, most people say, or eco grown, you can use that term.
So to him, it's not so much the term that's important, but rather the process the farmer uses.
That's as much a part of being organic in my mind as not using chemicals or whatever. It's the process and like how much petroleum you're using, the sustainability of it.
Michael wasn't always dedicated to this lifestyle. He co-founded Living Roots 3 years ago after completely changing his life path. First, he got a business degree and then got a job in an industry that he now loathes. Big corporate chemical.
And then I was just like, really start asking the question of like, what's my bigger purpose here? What's going to fulfill me in my life? And like, it's not sitting at a desk being an accountant for a big chemical corporation that I was working for. And then so I just started asking the question, and it took a long time.
And now his professional life is completely chemical-free. This idea of life fulfillment is something Michael and the rest of the Living Roots community focuses on, and it stretches beyond farming.
We'll have like a lot of artist people come and creative kind of people that don't want like a corporate work environment, and they can do their own thing. So it is about creating an umbrella here that where people can do what they love to do.
And as for Michael, he knows he's found his place at Living Roots. Back to this whole organic thing. So they believe in this completely. They farm organic, live organic, everything organic, but they choose not to be certified. Here's why.
You have to write down basically like all your pounds of harvest for like each vegetable, and you have to write down your sales of harvest for each vegetable, and you have to write everything you put in your fields, and it just goes a little bit too far.
Michael knows this firsthand. He used to be certified, but stopped because he became disenchanted with the process. Another reason he turned away from certification is that he believes organic should focus on the soil, but the USDA doesn't even test the soil for chemicals.
I mean, organic really focuses on soil, and it's, you know, when you're focusing on the soil, you can plant in different ways. And we're also like, our methods of harvesting are much more organic. It's not like you're just taking big tractors and harvesting with tractors. We're harvesting with people, and so we can plant in smaller spaces.
Not being certified hasn't hindered Living Roots' success. They have over 100 families that pick up produce on a weekly basis, sell at various farmers markets, and deliver their produce to local restaurants. So if you can be so successful without being certified, why does the system exist?
I think it's still better to have the system, but it's really set up for large farms. I mean, we grow a lot of food, but we're still a small, like, family-sized farm. And so, yeah, it's set up for, like, you know, shipping organic produce, certified organic produce across the country where you can't meet your farmer. It's like most of our customers, they know our practices are really organic and that's the kind of farming we do.
For WFIU's Earth Eats, I'm Jamie Ordonez.
This story was a collaboration with Earth Eats and the Indiana University School of Journalism. Coming up, farmer Teresa Bertels asked chef Dave Talent what foods he wanted her to grow.
And I think that was a little bit of a different angle also for him, because he was used to coming to the market to buy whatever was available at the market.
How that business relationship came to be on Earth Eats. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab and Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats. Hi, I'm Annie Corrigan. No cooking happening today in Chef Daniel Orr's kitchen. He's making a couple raw recipes. Take a listen.
So we're going to do something completely different today, and we're going to do a salad with raw Brussels sprouts.
What I do is I've
cut them on a mandolin. A mandolin, it's something that is used a lot in France, and you could also use a knife and cut the Brussels sprouts as thinly as possible.
They're really beautiful.
Do you want to try one of these?
Love to.
Raw? I think that they almost have a little wasabi flavor in them.
They do.
And wasabi is actually, people think of it as being a horseradish root, but it's actually not. It's a member of the cabbage family.
It does have a little bit of a ping at the end there.
Mm-hmm. Mm. So we're just going to just toss these with a dressing that we're going to make right now. I've got a little bit of chopped garlic. We're going to kind of play off that little bit of heat with a little crushed red pepper. Got some scallions. Got a little bit of fresh thyme. Okay, now we're going to make the dressing by adding some olive oil. Finish seasoning with the lemon juice, salt, a little bit of Parmesan cheese, and some sunflower seeds to give it a little crunch. And we've toasted the sunflower seeds. Okay, and that's all there is to it. Let's serve it up and give it a taste. Cauliflower.
Love it.
Yeah, I love it too. A lot of people, it's kind of maligned. They don't like cauliflower. They don't like cabbage. They don't like broccoli. But I love cauliflower. And this is a really healthy recipe. We've got the head of the cauliflower, and you've got all this green on the outside. So I like to wash it off. And then this makes a great thing to dip with. My mom fights over the core. It could be used to make little coins out of it for dipping. But you also can use all of this in a cauliflower soup. You could throw some Polish sausage and some onions and some carrots and boil it up, and you have a great soup. Some little new potatoes. Okay, what we're going to do today is make cauliflower popcorn. Cut this up into little pieces, and then what we're going to do is take some nutritional yeast seasoning. Okay, this is Bragg, and it's a great gluten-free, sugar and salt-free vegetarian item that you can keep around and use as a sprinkle on mashed on potatoes or anything like that, and it's got some really good nutritional value to it. So we'll just toss some of that in, and we'll put a little salt and pepper, okay, and just toss it. It's simple as that. So you can sit around and the bowl this in front of the TV set or next to the computer screen and not feel guilty at all.
So simple, so straightforward, it almost seems silly to call these recipes at all, but you can absolutely see the ingredients list and pictures as well at eartheats.org. A lot of cookbooks pass through our office. We received one earlier this year for gluten-free baking. So I got connected with the author, Nicole Hun, on Skype.
My main thing, the reason I get up in the morning, other than the fact that I have two dogs, a cat, and children, is to disprove the idea that gluten-free food is only going to be good for gluten-free and not better.
When I have gluten-free bread, I'm not gluten-free myself, but when I have it, I know I'm eating it because it's just, it's more dense than the breads that I'm used to. Is there any way to get around that?
Are you kidding? Is that like the best softball question I've ever gotten?
She is the author of the cookbook Gluten-Free on a Shoestring Bakes Bread.
You shouldn't know. If you know, it's not good enough. Full stop.
Hun says the recipes in her book create bread that is indistinguishable from its gluten-full counterparts. Here's a one-minute pep talk with gluten-free baker and author Nicole Hun.
I really want people to raise their expectations. I want people to understand that if you can make it with gluten, we can make it without. And, you know, that's not necessarily the case with everything that you remove from your diet. I find that dairy is a lot harder to replace than gluten because the substitutes really just aren't that great, the ones that are available. But gluten-free, all you should do without is the gluten. Everything else should be fair game. Anything that you remember, because I think that's a large part of what upsets people when they first have to go gluten-free is they feel like they have to live without, and you do not. People often define their diets by whether or not they eat carbs, right? And what they're really talking about is bread. And if you decide that you don't want to eat bread because you want to eat low carb or no carb or anything like that, that should be a decision that you make that's a true choice. It shouldn't be something that you have to back into because you feel like it's not available. You should be making a choice from a position of strength, not a position of fear.
Thank you so much, Nicole. This has been
Thank
such
you,
a pleasure.
Annie. Likewise.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
Connect with Nicole Hun on her website and see lots of gluten-free recipes at glutenfreeonashoestring.com. In the first half of the show, we heard about California dairies looking for greener pastures in other parts of the country.
As drought, feed costs, and urban development wear on West Coast milk producers, states like Nebraska, Kansas, and Iowa are pitching themselves as a dairy heaven. For the Midwest, an influx of dairies isn't just about milk, it's about pumping dollars into the rural economy. Harvest Public Media's Grant Gerlach has the story.
Here's why you should move your dairy to Nebraska.
We have ample land. We have ample clean water because we live above an underground lake called the aquifer.
Willow Hollebeck is the executive director of AFAN, the Alliance for the Future of Agriculture in Nebraska.
That also means that we have a very stable feed supply because we are the number one irrigated state in the nation.
Hollebeck is one of Nebraska's primary dairy recruiters. Like ag officials from other Midwest states, Hollebeck has been going to big farm shows, pitching Nebraska as a dairy destination. California is ripe recruiting ground.
Dairymen in California are being surrounded by population. The price of land or development is high, and so they are really kind of landlocked.
So when you talk about a place with lots of water and open spaces, it gets the attention of dairy farmers like Marty DeHogue.
Connor, come from California, 6115, 1806. I bought from my buddy in Texas, 5469. They came from California.
DeHogue moved his dairy 1,400 miles from Southern California to Eastern Nebraska last summer. He's walking me through one of his barns near the town of Seward. There are 500 black and white Holsteins on the farm, but he seems to know each one by the number on its yellow ear tag.
I wrote every single ear tag in here, so I tagged her when she was a day old, you know, born the day she was born, so.
DeHogue is a third-generation dairy producer from the Chino Valley east of Los Angeles. Over 70 years, his family built a dairy business in what he says was once one of the most dairy-rich areas in the country.
Like our block in Southern California, there are six dairies on 160 acres. There was 4,000 milk cows on 160 acres.
So why would he uproot his family to move halfway across the U.S.? A big reason is the valley that used to be dairy country is quickly becoming part of the city.
Now within a mile, there's brand new housing tracts, and they're putting 7-8 houses per acre. You know, they're just, it's the only piece of open dirt available to build on between L.A. and Barstow, pretty much.
That creates other challenges. Feed for the animals has to be shipped in, making it more expensive. Manure has to be trucked out, sometimes up to 70 miles, so it can be spread on farm fields as fertilizer. DeHogue started shopping around for a new home. He looked at Idaho, Texas, and Colorado, but eventually settled on Nebraska. He's renting the dairy right now, but after the family property is sold out west, he wants to build a new farm, and that would mark a big economic investment for Nebraska. Jeff Kuhn is a retired dairy specialist with the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
Okay, just in the construction costs of building a new dairy, which would go right into the local community, we're talking about $5,000 to $7,000 a cow.
So, for example, it would take $14 to $15 million to build a new 2,000-cow dairy. And a dairy that size takes about 20 full-time workers.
Which in a lot of cases is more employees than a lot of their Main Street businesses employ.
With that kind of economic boost on the line, it's no wonder Nebraska has to compete with neighbors like South Dakota, Kansas, and Iowa on the dairy recruiting trail. California shouldn't worry about the Midwest poaching away its dairy industry. It's still the top dairy state. But Marty DeHogue says for him, Nebraska was a good move.
Yeah, I drive around here and see the fields of corn, fields of soybean and alfalfa. Everything's here, you know, and that's what you need.
One drawback, he was surrounded by dairies in California. Now he feels a little isolated.
Yeah, one buddy went to Idaho. A couple other dairymen from Northern California went to South Dakota, you know, Iowa.
And here you are in Nebraska.
Mm-hmm. And I came to Nebraska. I didn't know nobody.
The state is hoping that if their recruiting plan works, he won't stay lonely for long. Grant Gerlach, Harvest Public Media.
This reporter collective brings us stories about food and agriculture every week. Their website is harvestpublicmedia.org. Dairy on the Brain last week in Earth Eats. In case you missed it, we had a homemade cheese tutorial with Robin Morton. Download all our previous episodes from iTunes. Now the story of a match made in slow food heaven.
Every January, restaurant Talent offers an Italian menu. There's a picture of the spaghetti bolognese on their Facebook page, and wow, it looks delicious. There's one dish chef and owner Dave Talent says he has to put on that January menu year in and year out.
We've been doing this beet and goat cheese ravioli that it's the only pasta dish that I have to bring back every single time. So, I mean, it's a lot of people don't think they like beets, and then they have it and they're like, whoa, they're transformed.
He was a latecomer to beets himself.
I never had beets until I went to culinary school. The first time I had a roasted beet. You know, I was kind of transformed. I was like, okay, beets are really good. I don't understand why my mother never made us beets.
Talent sources as many ingredients from area farms as possible, like Teresa Bertel's Heartland Family Farm. January for Bertel's means poring over seed catalogs and prepping for spring planting. This is her second year on this 40-acre plot of land. She bought it so she could be on call to local chefs if they need a couple dozen eggs immediately, for instance.
I wanted to be in the position where I can just jump on the road and exactly 14 minutes, I'm downtown.
Her farm also includes sheep, bees, and chickens.
Katie!
Katie is the donkey that scares off predators. Bertel's primary business is custom growing for local restaurants like Restaurant Talent. She met Chef Dave over a decade ago when she was selling and he was shopping at the local farmers market. She flipped the script on the typical farmers market conversation, and she asked him what he wanted her to grow.
And I think that was a little bit of a different angle also for him, because he was used to coming to the market to buy whatever was available at the market.
Inside her house, she has copies of Food and Wine and Gourmet stacked on her coffee table. She does a lot of reading to keep up with food trends so she can grow the latest it ingredient. Pea shoots, for instance. When she started growing those, she was the only local source for pea shoots.
If you grow something different, something out of the ordinary, and you come to the back door of a kitchen and you call for your chef and he comes over and you show him this glorious thing that you've grown, I mean, they just light up like a Christmas tree. They're so excited because they are creative and artistic, and you've given them a new color to go on the palate.
The food from Heartland Family Farm will certainly be coloring the January menu at Restaurant Talent. You can learn more about both Teresa Bertel's and Dave Talent at eartheats.org. Our hardworking Earth Eats team includes Aabon Binder, Mark Chilla, Luann Johnson, Chad Bouchard, Liz Leslie, Betsy Shepard, Daniel Orr, Casey Zakin, and of course the reporters at Harvest Public Media. Production support for Earth Eats comes from Blooming Foods, now with 5 locations in Bloomington. Blooming Foods has supported locally produced food and artisanal goods since 1976. BloomingFoods.coop. Touchstone Wellness, providers of therapeutic massage and yoga instruction, offering a variety of healing massage styles and yoga levels at the corner of Buick Cadillac Boulevard and Auto Mall Road, one block east of College Mall Road. Touchstone Wellness Massage and Yoga, 812-337-3529 or 33RELAX. And Charles Schwab & Company Incorporated, now with a local branch on Morton Street in Bloomington. Independent branch leader Jeremy Zeichner, CFP, offers personalized financial plans matched to investors' goals. More at schwab.com/Bloomington. Earth Eats is a production of WFIU and Indiana Public Media. Will Murphy, executive producer. Thanks for joining us. It's Earth Eats. I'm Annie Corrigan.